Hello, welcome to Greenlit with me, the voice which belongs to Toby Earle. In each episode of Greenlit, a guest receives the thrilling news their life is to be made into a biopic, and we discuss how that story will be told. Will they star? Which moments won't make it into the adaptation? And will King Kong make an appearance? In this episode, comedian Ignacio Lopez will plot the course of this certain blockbuster. Lopez has starred in Live at the Apollo, Stand Up Sesh, and Breaking the News. He'll be performing at the final 10 days of the Edinburgh Fringe this year. He starts his UK tour on the 4th of October with his new show, Nine Ig Fails. His comedy album, Españolo, is available now. And in his spare time, he builds stepladders for reaching stepladders. Ignacio Lopez, welcome to Greenlit.
Thanks for having me, man. Looking forward to it.
Oh, well, it's really, really great to have you here. And I like the fact that we could do this in multiple languages because you have, you speak multiple languages, right? Your family tree is fascinating.
Yeah, it's all over the place. So I grew up in Mallorca, so I spoke Spanish first. And then my mom is Welsh-Irish, so I speak a little bit of Welsh as well. Enough to get by, at least living in Cardiff where I am now.
I know you're really keen to do this in English. I was asking to do it in Welsh and Spanish, but I know you insisted on English. Are you still?
Well, we've got to think about the box office, you know. And I mean, ultimately, English is still the most widely spoken, at least cinematically. You know, I would recommend Spanish, but then you've got all the issues with like the different dialects in South America and stuff. And
yes,
would they really kind of tune in to watch and listen to a Spaniard talking?
So before we get cracking, Ignacio, big question. Is it pronounced biopic or biopic?
I'd say biopic.
Biopic. Okay.
Yeah. I know it's a biological picture, right? That's what a biographical picture. That's an anatomy kind of thing, which I'm not. That's a very different project. No, it's a biographical picture, right? Is that what it's short for?
I mean, that to me sounds sensible. That sounds to me reasonable, a common sense approach to this thorny question. A biological picture, though. Wow. Now that would be something, wouldn't it?
It would be a David Cronenberg movie.
Yes. God, I mean, it sounds like we've thought about this and we may be veering into this territory at some stage of the conversation. I mean, I'm all for body horror in someone's in someone's biopic. So I look forward to finding out what that might be. Now, Ignacio, where is the meeting taking place with the executives? You're discussing this film. You're bringing your story to life, but where are you going to meet these executives to have this conversation? Are you going to have it at the studio? Are you going to have it at a fancy restaurant? Are you going to have it somewhere where you kind of own the territory a little bit more? Where would you have it?
I'd fly them out to Mallorca. I'd stick us go to the north of Mallorca where I grew up because it's going to feature in the film, obviously. Ooh. So I'd send them out. We'd sit there, Puerto Poyensa, looking out at the boats. Nice restaurant, you know, very classy. And just wow them a little bit, you know, show them a kind of the incredible settings you could have without a massive budget either.
Oh, see, you've already thought about this as well. This is the budget's already come into play early doors. I was not expecting that. And could you describe, so if that's, is that where you grew up in that part of northern Mallorca?
Yeah, so I was born in Palma, which is the capital of Mallorca, which is where a lot of my family live now. But I grew up in Poyensa, which is close to a very popular tourist destination, Alcudia, with a massive, beautiful beach. My dad had a bar there for a long time. And that's how I kind of, my first sort of meeting British people happened in that very bar. So that was my first instinct into what the UK was like before I came here.
Now, I must ask, Ignacio, what was, if that's where you first encountered British people, what were your impressions of British people when you met British people on holiday in a region of Spain? What was your impression of them?
I mean, just party central. I thought the UK was just going to be like a giant Butlins. That's what I expected when I came here. But actually, you know, it's nice. You get nice sort of variety of people coming and traveling abroad as well. And at the north of Mallorca, thankfully, it's not Ibiza. You know, it's a bit more relaxed and chilled out up the north of Mallorca.
Were you, when you arrived in the UK, were you a bit disappointed it wasn't a giant Butlins?
No, I mean, to be honest, the only thing that really kind of like shook me that I wasn't expecting is just how cold it was. And the torrential rain, the perpetual rain that it seemed to be when I came over. And I remember, you know, getting very annoyed with my mother and saying that, you know, my mother would be like, right, you know, we're going to go out today. I was like, but why? You know, it's raining, you know, it's not, you know, I'm going to stay indoors. And it turned me into a bit of a hermit when I was here. But it's so cold. When we went to, my friend and I went to Norway a few years ago, and he was shivering and he looked over at me and he said, oh my God, I've just realized this must be how you feel all the time in the UK. And I was like, yeah, pretty much. As you can see, even in my own home, I'm wearing, yeah. I'm layered up. I've got a hoodie and stuff now.
Well, I mean, times are hard. And if you can avoid putting the heating on, it's the thing to do these days, unfortunately. But I just, so when did you come over to the UK then? How old were you when you came to the UK?
First time we came over, I was 5 years of age. So just becoming sort of 6 years of age. As we came over, my mom and I, my mother was just trying to open up a business. And then my dad followed over and opened up a Spanish restaurant in Swansea, which didn't last very long. And when that closed down, when the people of Swansea kicked us out, we went back to Mallorca. And I've just been back and forth my whole life, really. So I very much consider Wales as much of my home as I do Spain.
So hang on a minute. Swansea didn't want a Spanish restaurant. Swansea rejected a Spanish restaurant.
No, I think it was a bit too, you know, like that scene in Back to the Future where Michael J. Fox is playing the guitar and he goes, you might not get this. It might be too advanced for you, but your kids are going to love it. And now everyone's bloody eating tapas around the UK and in Wales. But at the time, it took some convincing.
So you really, your family were Welsh tapas pioneers. You were paving the way for future tapas success.
Absolutely, yeah. I think my dad's restaurant was like the that gig that the Sex Pistols played at, that every member of the everybody who went there went and started a band. I think everyone who came to my dad's restaurant eventually went off and opened up their own tapas restaurant 10 years later.
Well, exciting news, Ignacio. Your life has been greenlit for a biopic. But how would your life be told by Hollywood or Bollywood or Nollywood? And what sort of creative control would you exercise in bringing the greatest story you know to the big screen? So, first big question, Ignacio. What's the film called? What is the biopic of Ignacio Lopez called?
Well, this is a complicated one because I think modern biopics, they all kind of like focus on maybe a song or a title, because mainly musical biopics get made these days. So you got stuff like Bohemian Rhapsody, mm-hmm. Or Rocket Man.
Yep.
Is the Elvis movie called Elvis? That might actually be the exception that breaks the rule. I think I'm not 100% on the title of that one.
It is Elvis.
Yeah. So I think sticking with probably the word I use the most in stand-up comedy would probably be either shithole, which might not be a great one for investors to tap into, because I like calling places shithole. In fact, the posher, the better for a town than shithole. So I will be using that a lot. But I think I'm going to be really boring and just call it Ignacio Lopez, the movie.
I mean, that has hints of two hints. Firstly, that was a TV show, which now has its first big screen outing. So everyone knows exactly what it is. Also, quite Disney. You know, I don't know why I went to Hannah Montana. I think that's a movie, right? But there is kind of like again, that sense of something quite unthreatening about it is literally going, just so you know, this is exactly what you expect, right? This is what you're going to get. There's no chance of being like surprised or offended.
Yeah, I think, I think you've actually convinced me there. I'm gonna change it. I'm going to go with Ignacio Lopez, the motion picture, just to kind of accurately show how pretentious I am.
Now, hang on. I'm sure didn't Star Trek, the motion picture? I'm sure that was the first.
Well,
first
maybe we're
series.
Going to go up, yeah, in scale the same way as Star Trek. Maybe we're going to start off with Star Trek, the motion picture style. Big budget.
Yes. But then, of course, you know, the return, you know, it wouldn't just be a standalone film. It would be the start of a franchise where every even numbered film is the best. So the second Ignacio Lopez film is really, really good. Everyone loves the second one. Third one, yeah. Fourth one. Oh, my God. It's got whales in it. Well, it literally would. It literally would have whales.
It would have whales in it, yeah.
You live and are part Welsh. So, okay, why not shithole? I mean, I do like the idea of Shuttle because it's quite a confrontational
title. Yeah, I think I wouldn't go with Shuttle because I think it would confuse people about what they were watching. So I'd hope that at least with Ignacio Lopez, the motion picture, you know, they know that they're going to come see a film about me. If you call a film Shuttle, it might give people the wrong idea. It might sound like an indie horror movie or something.
Yes.
You know, it's just, yeah, not the kind of thing I'm trying to push.
That is not, so you're staying away from independent horror film sort of energy and content is not what you want in this.
Yeah, I want it to feel more like, and also the last show I did in Edinburgh was called El Comico, which I thought would make a very good title for a movie. But I don't know, man, if we're telling my life story, I haven't been a comedian my entire life. And also, you know, is that what I'm going to be remembered for at the very end? We'll see. That's kind of what this is, a journey, right?
Oh, that's... So hang on. You don't necessarily wish to be remembered as a comedian, just solely a comedian.
I'm going to be a comedian for the rest of my life. I love this and I'm never going to stop. But like, I went to film school, man. So I want to be making movies, you know? That's kind of a dream for me.
And I think we found your first feature project, haven't we? No, no wonder you're thinking about budgets so early on. We found your first project. This is all coming together beautifully. Can I ask as well, though, about Shithole? You say it's probably the word you use most in your stand-up, referring to places, particularly when they're posh or, yeah, you know, well-heeled. What's the reaction like when you call these places you're gigging in shitholes?
It varies, man. Either people all laugh immediately because, you know, it's so ridiculous that I'm calling the place a shithole and everyone gets that, or the place is a shithole and everyone kind of like laughs in kind of solidarity. They're like, yeah, you're right, man, it is a shithole, we do live in a shithole. Or it could be Maidenhead, where you just get audible gasps from the whole audience. how dare he call it a shithole, you know?
Wait, what stage of the set did you call Maidenhead a shithole?
I pretty much open calling the town a shithole. I did like on my set at Apollo as well. I did my opening joke, I think, was calling London a shithole. And you do get like a mix of reactions. But most people, they realize it's a comedy show and they're like, where's he going with this? Before we beat him up, let's listen to what he's got to say.
What, and you know, when you heard there were audible gasps from the Maidenhead crowd, how long did it take to win them back? Did you have to win them back or were they gone?
The next line. No, I doubled down because everyone goes like, how dare you? And then I explain like, no, I'm from, I'm from Mallorca. I grew up in Poyenza where, you know, overlooking where the king of Spain docks his ship. And then I called them all landlocked losers, I think was the word that I used for Maidenhead.
So hang on, where you grew up in Mallorca, that's a place where royalty would visit.
Well, it's where the King of Spain docks his ship in the Puerto Poyenza. So it's his yacht.
Yeah.
So it's quite a fancy area, not where I grew up. I grew up on the hill where you can't see the Puerto Poyenza and everything. We live up on the mountain and stuff, but it is a very affluent area just on the right on the coast there. So,
right. And so yeah. It's not the place where the royal yacht docks just to discharge the septic tanks. And like, you go, just I'll do it here because this place is a shithole, and I'll just pollute the waters and then sail off somewhere else nicer.
No, it's super picturesque, man. It's where he parks up for most of the year. You know, if you lived in a caravan, you got to pick a plot, something that you want to look at. He chose it because of that.
You know, I'd never really thought of a yacht as a caravan before.
Just a sea caravan, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? It's just a sea caravan. Just going around, sloshing around, walking, treading on top of your own filth. Just getting, you know, that's all it is, really. God, you know what? People pay millions for those yachts and essentially they're just caravans.
Crazy. Absolute nuts.
And so you went to film school. You went to film school. Okay. What did you make at film school?
So I went to the International Film School of Wales, which was in Newport. It doesn't exist anymore. The campus, beautiful old campus, is now where they film the TV show Sex Education. So the high school in Sex Education was my university, the Netflix show.
Wow.
Yeah, beautiful place, cool school. I went into film school. I do this with a lot of things I get into, really. I went into film school thinking that we got to make like a feature-length movie. And straight away, they sit us all down and they're like, you're not going to make a feature-length movie in this course, this three-year degree. You know, they said by the end of your degree, you will make a short film. And I was like, oh, for Christ's sake. I had a stack of like feature length films ready to go right out the gate. But it was a great experience, man. I met some really cool people. Some of them do work in the film industry now. Some of them work in pornography, which is kind of like a natural progression if you're trying to make money with, you know, technical skills. And I went off and became first a musician, then a stand-up comedian.
Oh, I know this is about you, but I am intrigued to know the jobs that people got in the adult entertainment business off the back of working at film school. I mean, yeah. I know there are jobs like, you know, I've worked on a film, but I know, you know, you get jobs like grip and key grip, which in the porn industry, I guess, could be very different things. What are the jobs your friend's doing in porn?
One of them directs it. He started his own kind of production company. And I think an adult entertainment actress got in touch with him to book him for some stuff or some shoots. And I think it just turned out to be very lucrative. And he went into that full time, you know, so he stopped shooting weddings and started shooting wedding nights. You know, that's what the...
Wow. It's very, I suppose, you know, I bet, I suppose you're kind of proud of him, but like, it's very hard to kind of keep up with maybe his work. Does he or she send you links going, oh, do you want to check out my latest film? Or do you send again? No, I get the picture. I understand.
Let's just say it's not listed on his LinkedIn. But he's making good money, man. He's it's a very lucrative industry. It's not something that appealed to me. Like, I like scripting entertainment and, you know, I imagine there is a script.
Yeah,
I haven't gone into that much depth with him. Last time I had a drink with him was about 6 years ago. And he was just bemoaning the state of the industry and the algorithm, which is something as a stand-up comedian now, I very much appreciate and understand that that bloody algorithm stopping people seeing your stuff. So say, for instance, I mean, back then he was saying about, I can't remember what he was saying, the search topics were, and the way that the adult film business has gone, it's like whatever the top search terms are, that's you halt production on everything, and that's what you start shooting. So right. Like, for instance, if somebody was searching for choose wisely,
I guess, is what I'm
yeah saying. I was trying to think of something funny that wasn't a search term, you know, something that people might listen to this and go, wait a second, we haven't seen that porn.
Check
it out, like clown porn, you know, and then maybe like go look at that. Say for instance people were searching for clown porn, that's topping the search result, then he'd be like, right, we got to start churning out clown porn because that's all people are searching for, you know. It's just really, it's crazy the way it works. And I think with comedians now, they see people doing very successful things on TikTok, and they try to emulate that. And I think you see a lot of recycled stuff happening instead of people kind of making their own trends, they're kind of following other ones.
And that's what you found. I mean, did you try to engage with that, or did you just kind of think, this is not worth my while? Or did, you know, what does it, is that kind of thing really sort of homogenizing comedy?
I think, especially from when I started doing stand-up, I've always tried to do something a bit different. So a lot of the comics I was seeing on stage at the time were kind of moaning about, you know, being rubbish with women, or, you know, being very self-deprecating. And I just, right from my first ever gig, I came out super high status and just bragged about how incredible I was, just as a kind of, you know, antidote to all of the comedy people had sat through that night. And it kind of stuck. So it's, you know, it's gotten a bit softer. I'm not quite as harsh, but I am still going up on stage calling where anyone ever is from a shithole. So it's, you know, it's definitely still there.
I'm really intrigued by you going to school in what is now a fictional school, which seems like such a cuss on the actual institution. That place looks, I'm assuming the interiors aren't necessarily filmed in the actual building.
No, they're not.
Right.
Just the outside.
Just the outside. What was it like going to school there? Because that school looks absolutely beautiful and like an incredible location.
Well, it's as a university, it was incredible because it feels proper, you know, like what you picture university to be in the UK, which is very much like almost like a castle, you know, super. And it's got a rich history and stuff, like beautiful stone building. And then next to it, this is just kind of typical of kind of the education system in the UK as well. They built, I think they spent millions on it was effectively an art school.
Yeah.
They spent, so I was in the film campus, which was at the very back in this old 80s, like almost plastic building kind of hidden away. And that's where we kind of like had our main lectures and stuff. And then in the front of the building, they built this huge glass monstrosity they spent millions on for the fashion students. They built this fashion campus because that was like they were pumping all the money into that. So we're all there in this horrible, drippy building that's kind of, you know, well past its prime. And the fashion students coming to the UK were all treated to that beautiful thing. I think it lasted about 2 years, and then they moved the entire university to the center of Newport. Into like modern buildings, and they've knocked that glass building down. What a complete waste of money. What an admin mess up.
Really? It's gone?
Yep, gone. Because I went there recently, because it's no longer a university. They're turning it into flats. Of course they are.
Of course they are. Of course
this historical university in Wales. Yeah, just turn it into flats. And I took my girlfriend to see it because she'd not been there before. And I wanted to kind of like get a bit of nostalgia trip. I haven't been there for like a decade or whatever. And yeah, arrived, took a look around, and it's just, yeah, it's all flats. And that fashion building is long gone. What a complete waste of metal and supplies and people's time, you know?
What was it like being at university with fashion students, you know, film students, fashion students? Was there a tension? Was there a rivalry? Was it, you know, Jets and Sharks? Was there like a...
I'll tell you where the rivalry existed. It was between, because they had a very good documentary department as well. So I was in basically film school, and then you had this documentary school as well, which is part of the campus. That's where the real rivalry kind of thing, because we were trying to share equipment and facilities and stuff.
Yeah.
And I got to be honest, man, like I'm not a huge fan of documentaries. I prefer fiction. I like fictionalized worlds and concepts and, you know, talking about things, not necessarily directly about what they are, but, you know, metaphor and playing with concepts.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was it like when you watched Sex Education? Did it weird you out? Were you just kind of weirded out to see your old school?
Yeah, I had a good warning. Like a friend of mine was working on it, and they said like, you're never going to guess where we're filming this Netflix show, which we didn't know how successful it was going to be or anything either. I was like, where? He said, oh, the old campus. I was like, you're joking. Like, what's the show? And he goes, oh, it's going to be a high school. And I was like, what is this massive building? I was like, what kind of high school is that? But I think, I don't actually watch the show. Is it rich kids in it? Is it proper kind of?
It's kind of what they've done is they've taken all the tropes of American high school films and sort of brought them into what you described as this beautiful sort of castle-esque in British schools. And it's sort of a fantasy. It's sort of playing with the American high school tropes in a completely different context. So it's quite smart and fun, but there were people who were very confused by it at the first and didn't quite why is everyone speaking with like an English accent or a British accent? So we've got the title, Ignacio Lopez, The Motion Picture. Ignacio Lopez, The Motion Picture. I'm assuming it's just you on the poster, right? Is it just you on the poster?
Well, poster man, I'd love to do something like, you know, maybe one of the Hitchcock posters from the 60s, you know, whatever. That would be quite fun. I forget the name of the illustrator and somebody
Saul Bass.
To this. That's it, Saul Bass, of course it is. Yeah, so something like that would be quite cool. Something stylized, not exactly, you know, maybe teasing it a little bit because the title's quite on the nose. It'd be nice to do something a little bit different with the poster.
Do you know what's always nice sometimes, you know, like, do you know what adds a sense of mystery is when it's like, someone like in profile in shadow or a cutout, you know what I mean? You get a profile of their face and you're like, who could this person be? Well, it's Ignacio Lopez, but
it says right there. Yeah.
He's a mystery guy, right? He's like a mysterious dude. So we've got the film. I think we've got probably even nailed down the poster, but what's the opening scene, Ignacio? What is the opening scene?
So when I was in college, my film lecturer in college made a very good point. He's like, if you want to make any film seem smart, just write the script and then completely mess up the order. All right. So I think, you know, Tarantino is obviously a big fan of this mode of storytelling. But I think the opening scene, I'd love it to start off with quite a jarring image of what people would expect of my film to be, is me in front of a firing squad. So I think the opening scene is, you know, it's raining. I'm drenched. I'm covered in mud and I'm there. And there are maybe like 5 or 6 people with rifles about to execute me.
That is such a strong opening. How's he going to get out of this, you wonder?
Exactly. And then we jump back. How did he get in this situation in the first place? So.
Oh, I love, I mean, what's the setting? Is it in the middle of a, you know, is Ignacio Lopez up against a kind of a sandy wall, you know, or is it like a brick wall? What's the sort of environment? It's raining clearly and there's sort of maybe droplets coming off the end of the barrels and all that. But where are we?
I'd want to keep a bit of mystery. So I think maybe a concrete wall, because it could be anywhere in the world, and maybe a plain gray wall. You know, lots of rainfall, desaturated colors and stuff.
Yes.
Really kind of contrast my early upbringing and the beautiful orange sandy shore in Spain.
So I just got to ask, the desaturation, something that is that to do with time as well, to denote a different period of time? Or is that just to emphasize the difference in location, like you say, to your childhood, to where we find you?
Yeah, I think it's just a kind of hyper stylized way of doing it. Like, I'm a big fan of visual storytelling. And so it wouldn't be sort of black and white. It wouldn't be quite monosaturated or anything or monochromatic, but it would definitely just to give the feeling of almost futility and something is gone very, very wrong. There's no life left in this.
You mentioned at the start that you had a stack of scripts ready to go when you're at film school. Are we basically getting some of the best moments you remember from those scripts in this? is this your opportunity to bring together lots of, you say, like, everything in a random order to make it seem like a smart film? Are we just getting some really random stuff from several dozen scripts?
Maybe. I mean, well, it's all kind of like still up there, I think. Some of them I've burnt for a good reason. You know, I was not as good a writer 15 years ago as I thought I was. So this it's maybe an opportunity to right those wrongs.
What were some of the scripts that you wrote? Can you remember? Do you even want to share what some of those were, what the stories were?
I just remember really annoying my lecturers because I refused to kind of, A, stick to the brief, and B, you know, write a realistic sort of script in terms of budget and possibility. Like, I was just under the impression, I was like, go big and work towards that, you know? So I used to have like the most ridiculous scenes and locations in my scripts. So my lecturers would be like, yeah, but how do you think you're going to film this? And to be honest, it all built up and, you know, bit of a payoff at the very end, my graduate film. Like, we did it all. We had green screen. We had these, you know, we did stuff that no other person on the course was doing, because just sheer force of will and working three jobs and spending all my money on this film that wasn't going to make any money back. But we surprised a lot of people by going a bit nuts on the film.
What was the short film then? In the end, what was the story in that short film?
Well, I believe in high concept, so I had it was a building complex, like a flats called Evasive Heights, and that was the title of the movie, and it was all of these characters who were in some way, shape, or form like trying to escape the reality of their lives, like they were all living this horrible life. And this one character who was sort of the guy who looks after the building, like the superintendent or whatever, he was like in a little bit of a creepy way, but like spying on all the inhabitants and just realizing how unhappy everyone was. So then he tried to help them in some way. So he was trying to like fix their lives. So, you know, you expect in a short film there to be like maybe like four characters max, like one main character, one location. You know, it's meant to be a 10-minute movie. We built like 16 sets.
Holy shit. Like
different rooms. Yeah. Well, this is what blew my lecturer's mind. They weren't expecting this at all. They expected us to like shoot on location. And I found a warehouse in Barry Docks where they store old sets from BBC shows.
Wow.
This was years ago. It's not there anymore. But we hired that place out. And then we started building the sets ourselves, building them up. I worked in a carpet and furniture shop at the time. So we were getting like different carpets for all the different rooms to differentiate them, wallpaper, paint, furniture. So we did every single one. And then we had a cast of about 12 primary kind of like characters with names. And then we did this huge scene we shot in the warehouse, which was meant to be at the end of the, at the end, he decides the only way to kind of truly free these people is to burn the building down. So we did a CG like fire on the building, and we had all of these extras, like maybe 40 extras in this warehouse to make it look like it was outside. And then we had to light it as if like they were looking up at the glow of the fire and stuff. And we had like drove a car into the warehouse. It was nuts, man. We just went really overboard. And a car on the way back one day between Barry and Newport, we witnessed a car crash. A car flipped over. There were some guys who'd stolen a car and they were just joyriding and they flipped this car. So we called an ambulance and the fire brigade and they all came. And we had all our film gear with us. So we filmed the entire thing. So we had the perfect cutaways of the fire brigade like at on scene. It was just, it could not have gone any better, man. It was very serendipitous.
Just to be clear, you didn't pay those joyriders to steal a car and get into an accident so that you had something to film.
and nobody was hurt. That is important.
I can't believe the scale of the ambition for a start, the fact that you pulled it off, and the fact that you also managed to have that happen in front of you to give you the perfect inserts for the film. Why aren't you in film, Ignacio? That sounds like you made that happen. What happened? How was it received by the lecturers?
It went down really well, and we got full grade and everything for that, full marks. But filmmaking, it is difficult, but also what I learned through film school and even doing some stuff after is just, it's just built on compromise all the time. Like, you're just constantly compromising what you want to do. So I came up with the idea. I was like, well, I'm just going to work on other stuff, make my money elsewhere, and then just finance my own movies. That's the plan. So one day, maybe in my 50s or something, I'll have been a successful enough stand-up comedian that I can finally turn around and make a movie.
So are you an uncompromising individual, do you think? Is that why you just didn't want to give up on being told what you couldn't do?
I think it's good to have limitations sometimes. I think the best films come out of that. So you definitely need somebody on hand to kind of like be looking at you. Do we really need helicopters in this scene? But we tried.
You can have helicopters in this. You can have helicopters
great,
in this.
Man. We tried to get helicopters, man. It's a lot harder than you think. And I didn't realize, but you need, you need to get, if you're going to fly over a city, it's not allowed to be a dual engine, or it has to be a dual engine helicopter, I think, or something. And then you need permission from the council, the various councils. And yeah, it's very stressful. Producing, I think, is definitely the hardest job in film. And I don't want to do it. I want to get successful enough to employ a good shit-hot producer.
I just had to note the fact that it's such a great line that you said there. I've tried to get helicopters. It's a lot harder than you think. I mean, that is. I kind of assumed it would be quite hard to get. And I just like the thought of going, no, it should be fine. It should be fine. They're everywhere. So you got full marks for that. You know. You said you filmed the emergency services arriving for these individuals who'd stolen the car. Have you seen the film Nightcrawler with Jake? Right. At no point did you think, actually, if I film this, I can sell the footage to a news network. And you suddenly thought, what if I became one of those camera operators who goes around looking for accidents and bad things?
I mean, I did. At one point, we were sat there filming it. The first thought of a few people in the car with us was like, oh, we could, you know, would the news want this footage or anything? But then you got to realize just like how, you know, common it is for a car to flip while people are joyriding near Bari. So we're kind of like, it's not really, you know, enough people have this footage. We could have sold the footage, and we shot it in nice HD at the time as well, which wasn't very common. It was people still shooting on standard definition. But no, it never occurred to me to go do that. I want to be creative, you know? And I don't mean like creative as in Jake Gyllenhaal setting up, you know, car accidents and murders and stuff in order to make money out of it.
Very, very much like the, you know, being Welsh tapas pioneers, you were ahead of the curve again with high definition cameras. Because, yeah, that was a rare thing. You know, I guess what, 10, 15 years ago? Like 15 years ago for sure would have been very unusual.
Yeah, it was. I think it was 2000. I got the camera in 2007. It was actually a mini HDV. Mini HDV. So with high definition tape, which was, I mean, even now, just how much technology has changed. Like, I can shoot stuff on my phone that's like eight times the resolution of what we were shooting on this tape. And also you can airdrop it to stuff. Whereas back then you had to sit there and transfer the footage from the tape in real time. You couldn't do it. You couldn't like fast forward it and transfer it. So to get it on my computer, you had to sit there, and if you'd shot an hour's worth of footage, it was going to take an hour. Then the computer to process it. It was, very time consuming.
Kids today, eh? Kids today.
Tell me about it.
So we've got a great opening scene, a firing squad. We don't know what stage this is. I've not seen a good firing squad scene for a long time. I feel like it's been overlooked, I think, recently in modern cinema.
Yeah, I think, it's quite a depressing image, and I think people have tried to stay away from that. But I think it'd be a cool, you know, it's not going to be in the trailer. No. So I think it would be a kind of just wake people up as they're walking into the cinema with their buckets of popcorn and, you know, huge gallon drinks, and just sitting down and being like, oh, wow, we were not expecting, you know, this.
Poor Ignacio. Are you tied to a stake like in the old days, or are you just stood against the wall?
I think just stood against the wall.
You know, they used to do that, didn't they? Would they had the arms tied behind the back, weren't they? And then they shout "Vive la Revolution!" Generally.
Yeah, man. I think I'd want to have like my hands free, because I'd want to be like smoking maybe a last cigarette or something like that. You know, just really kind of cliches. No, I don't even smoke, but it'd be a good thing to put in the film.
You know, when they say like any last request, you know, a final cigarette, and you end up getting like one of those enormous cigars to give you about 2 or 3 hours just to think about how to get out of this situation. Like, can we go? No, hang on. I've still got a good hour and a half on this guy left.
Yeah. Or any last words? And like, yeah, actually. And then just perform my Edinburgh show from 2015. I'm not done yet.
Is there enough persuasive material in that 2015 show to make the firing squad reevaluate their career choices and whether or not they feel morally comfortable with what they're about to do?
The first few minutes will be really uncomfortable as well. I'll be like, so what do you do for a living? I'm an executioner. I'm here to shoot you, mate. Oh yeah, of course, man. How'd you get into that?
Shot anyone interesting recently? Right, okay, yeah, the guy just ahead of me. Yeah, I remember him. Well, I mean, it's a powerful opening scene. It's very strong, but Ignacio, who is against the wall when Ignacio Lopez, the motion picture begins? Who is playing Ignacio Lopez? Who's cast as a lead?
Well, this is what I quite like about, because we're going to be jumping through eras as well. You're going to have different different ages. And I think this particular one should be an older, kind of more grizzled Ignacio. Ooh. You know, I think, somebody who I think would play the part very well is somebody who I would dreamt of casting as my dad years ago when I was thinking about this sort of situation, because they're similar age and they look very similar. Jimmy Smith. So
yes.
I think Jimmy Smith would be a great older
Jimmy
Ignacio.
Smith. Yeah. What is it about Jimmy Smith that appeals to you as to playing an older Ignacio? And why did you think of him playing your dad in a previous role? I mean, Jimmy Smith's getting so much work off of you. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. Jimmy Smith's getting so much work. But what's the reasons for him playing your dad and also you?
Well, I think now, especially because I wouldn't cast him as my dad in this one, I think. But originally when I was thinking of, because he looks so much like my dad, I think, and I look a lot like my dad, obviously younger version. So I think he'd be a good choice to play that. And obviously he can speak Spanish as well. So if there's like Spanish dialogue necessary, he's Puerto Rican. He'll have to, you know, learn the Mallorquin dialect and, you know, try and picture that. But he's a great actor, so I'm sure he'd absolutely nail it. He's just an all-round cool guy. I'd like to work with him as well. It'd be fun.
Handsome man. Some handsome genes going through the Lopez family.
Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly one of the things I push in my act on stage as well, is talking about how good looking I am. I want to point out as well, anybody's listening at home, I don't think I'm as good looking as I make out. I want to point that out.
How is it being so good looking, Ignacio? Could you share with the rest of us what it's like to be so sort of knee-wobblingly gorgeous? How do you cope? What's life like for someone like you?
You know, you just take it one day at a time. It's a lot to deal with, obviously. You know, the looks you get on sort of public transport, on megabus, etc. Feel a bit out of place sometimes.
Do you like being objectified, being so desperately gorgeous, or do you find it invasive?
No, I don't think it's. What's strange is that I do think the stereotype of like Spanish people being quite arrogant is definitely brought on by like the matriarchs and the women in people's family growing up, because like all my aunts, like my dad had so many sisters, they'd all the time, they're like, ah, qué guapo, like how handsome, that's all they tell you when you're a kid. But they are also, on the flip side, they can be very brutal as well. So, you know, it's also qué guapo, and then, you know, you grow a little bit older, and they kind of like, qué gordo, which means how fat. So like, you just went, you know, it's real, you know, they're really playing with your emotions and your self-image there.
A lot of it's I don't know, is passive aggressive the right way to describe this?
No,
I mean,
just
it's
aggressive.
Just aggressive.
There's no passive about it.
It's also, you know, it's almost like the way the British tabloids operate, and like they like to build people up, then knock them down. give them loads of love and support, and then all of a sudden just chop their legs off, take their legs away from them.
I think, yeah, definitely. I think we're going to find out secretly that like the whole time Richard, what's his name? Rupert Murdoch was controlled by just like six Spanish women.
What a twist that would be. That would be an incredible twist. Are they actually in his body, or are they kind of just like he's got an earpiece and they're all shouting, telling him what to do?
either just controlling him like from the back. he might not even be real. He might be sort of like an AI. We don't know. Maybe technology jumped ahead way sooner than we thought.
Oh my God. Imagine if that came out as true. That would be so great. So it turns out that is beautiful as a thought. I just the very thought of just six Spanish women shouting instructions into his ear, like Ant and Dec on their secret camera bit in Saturday Night Takeaway. You mentioned Jimmy Smits playing an older version of Ignacio. Did you have someone younger in mind? Did you have a younger version?
Yeah, or were you quite... I've seen them using youth effects on him and stuff. I think Pedro Pascal would be a good shout.
Oh, come on.
I mean, I have had comparisons made before. So I think that would be kind of a good one to play me slightly older than I am now, when hopefully more exciting stuff has happened to me for my movie.
How much of a fan of his work are you? Do you enjoy his work?
Yeah, I do. I've really been enjoying The Last of Us. I think I put off watching a lot of his stuff for a long time because people were like, "You look like this guy," and then I'd be like, "All right," and then I'd watch it, and he's a good-looking guy, Latino, but I'd watch. The first scene anyone ever showed me of his, they're like, "You look just like this guy," and it was him getting his face caved in Game of Thrones. So I was like, "Yeah, I don't really want to."
Before or after
comparison?
Before or after he gets his
during?
Face, during.
They showed me the scene they showed me was during. They were like, "Oh, check this out." I was like, "Oh, Jesus Christ!" But I think it's a nice comparison pre-face gave
in. Pre-face. I mean, again, just as his eye sockets are crushed and his nose breaks and his face collapses, you're just pausing it and going, "Look, it's just like you," eyes collapse. Have you seen The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent?
Incredible film. And it's filmed in Mallorca and it's set in Mallorca as well. Yeah, so I watched that. I was very jealous that they got to go shoot a movie in the very picturesque island that I grew up on.
He's funny. Pedro Pascal is funny. And like, I think you see him quite often in dramatic roles, which have the humor, but even so, you know, he's very funny in this.
Yeah, he's got great timing, man. And I think that really showed it off. If you can hold your own in any scene with Nick Cage going like full manic Nick Cage, then I think you've got some skills. If anything, I think he's overqualified to play me, but I don't care. It's my movie.
Well, the thing is, he might be overqualified, but he isn't as handsome as we worked that out. So, you know, the two things kind of balance out.
Sure.
So we've got Pedro Pascal. We've got Jimmy Smits. You know, they've both worked across a range of genres. You've already ruled out indie horror, but what genre would Ignacio Lopez, the film, be? And what kind of budget are we looking at?
I think I'd love it to be a comedy. You know, that makes sense. Being funny has always been important to me. Even in film school, the most important thing in presentations wasn't my grade. It was, did I get any laughs during my presentation? The films that I did make when I first got there just ended up being comedies. It's always been super important. So it's definitely going to have to be a comedy movie. But I love comedies that are played straight. So I think, I was watching I do love the Zucker Brothers movies, the, you know, Naked Gun and stuff. They are hilarious. But the best moments in those are when the actors are playing it straight. You know, they're not kind of gurning for the camera or anything. Those for me are the best jokes. So I think it would be played completely straight, but with a comedic twist.
Which of your favorite of the Zucker Cruz films which of their works is your favorite? Is it Airplane or is it Naked Gun?
I'm not sure, man. I probably fluctuate on it. I think for me, Airplane is the purest of the form. But like, you know, the Police Squad TV show and the movies, the Naked Gun movies are fantastic, man. There's so many great jokes in that. I think Naked Gun and Police Squad has got some better quality jokes in it, but just for pure laugh out loud silliness and consistency, Airplane is just nonstop. I found out how they edited that. They cut the movie and then they took it around college campuses and played it for students. And at any point in time, if anyone wasn't laughing, they like made a note and that's what they cut out of the movie. So it's purely down to the pure funniest. You know, what a method, what a way to edit the movie.
Yeah,
it's a miracle it makes sense.
Yeah, you're right. You're completely right. Yeah, that there's still a narrative within that actual movie because they ended up stripping out, I mean, all the plot, all the exposition and that's amazing. I don't know. I've never heard of a film being edited in that way before. That seems deeply unusual, deeply unique. You know, you mentioned Police Squad there, and that does have one of the greatest cut lines in comedy history of all time. And it's the one where Frank Drebin goes into a guy's office, and the guy in the office says, "Who are you? How did you get in here?" And Leslie Nielsen replies, Frank Drebin replies, "I'm a locksmith, and I'm a locksmith."
Yeah, perfect, man. It's just excellent lines, perfectly executed, man. That's what you need.
I think as well, you know, when they play it straight, I think that it also means, I think it gives it a certain timelessness as well, because there's no, it doesn't feel self-indulgent. It doesn't feel like, you know, anything of the moment. It feels like, because it feels dramatic at the same time somehow, it never kind of loses its edge, because you wonder how on earth those guys didn't just start laughing all the way through, maybe.
Have you seen a stupid and futile gesture?
Oh, I mean, I've made many, but I don't know which one's that.
It's on Netflix. It's got a great cast. It stars Will Forte, and it's the story of the guy who founded, one of the guys who founded the National Lampoon, and went on to make those movies and stuff. And it's his biopic. And you know, I think that's, for me, it's almost the perfect movie. It's the kind of movie you should aspire to make. I think mine would be slightly more serious, but you know, because they're very, very slapstick moments in it as well. But it's a great movie, worth checking out.
And so which parts of your life would feature in Ignacio Lopez, the motion picture? I mean, maybe you will take it around universities and colleges to see what the audience likes and doesn't like. But maybe at the start of it all, you're going to work out what parts of your life in there. What parts of your life are in the film?
Well, I think it's important to show, you know, a struggle as well. So I think my childhood would be a case of leaving Mallorca, you know, my experience over there to start with, trying to fit in with my cousins and family, friends, and then moving over to Wales, trying to fit in over here, having no idea what the hell rugby is, and just really getting thrown in the deep end there. So there'd be, I think, some good comedy value and also drama from just a kid getting uprooted and sent to a place he knows nothing about, really, other than, like I said, a few holidaymakers here and there. Yeah, and then a case of heartbreak, you know, my parents separating, them going to different countries, me bouncing back and forth. And then that's kind of that travel. Then you could almost jump cut to me jumping on trains and planes and stuff to do stand-up comedy as well. It's like I've never really kind of like stuck in one place, moving all over the place. So I think that would be a nice cyclical kind of like nature of it. So showing like upbringing, trying to make kids laugh, trying to fit in. And then there I am on stage trying to do the same again. Going up on stage, calling the town a shithole and seeing how I can dig myself out of the situation.
Are the reason you're so itinerant or so regularly on the move is because you call so many places shitholes and you cannot stay in any one place because people will be coming after you.
I think it's, I don't know quite exactly how I get away with doing what I do, but I'm glad I do. And people are quite, you know, I think, people tune into very quickly. They're kind of like, "Oh, right, he's taking the piss," and it's from a place of like friendship. You know, like when you're with your best friends, the people you're cruelest to the most, I think, are your friends in the stuff that people say and do and act and stuff. But in a loving, funny way, and I think that's what I try and do on stage as well. I'd never make fun of something just to be mean. It's always from a place of like, "Come on, we're all friends here. We're just messing around."
So what was it like then when you first arrived in the UK? You said it was a bit of a culture shock. And so can you describe, do you remember that culture shock? And also, can you talk a little bit more about rugby? What on earth, like, what do you mean rugby? Were you made to play it? Were you forced to play it at school or something?
Yeah. So I went to school in a place called Ponta d'Água, where my mom is from, for a while. And like, yeah, just had no idea. And the thing is, I was a very small kid as well. Like I was, you know, not some of these Welsh kids, I'm telling you, man, they at sort of, you know, pre-teens, they looked like adults. It was nuts. And there I am on a rugby pitch with them. I was the size of the rugby ball. You know, they might as well have just passed me back and forth. It was a scary situation to be thrown into.
Did you take a pasting on the rugby pitch, I'm assuming?
Oh, man, I still don't think I can throw a rugby ball properly. I don't think I was getting tackled before it even reached me. You know, it was nuts. Just eating floor, muddy Welsh fields. That's what my diet was when I moved to the UK.
To be fair, British food isn't exactly great. So muddy Welsh fields is probably actually, you know, Almost a delicacy, I would say. What was it? But how did you cope? How did you cope with that change as a kid, like moving over here?
Made friends with some other outsiders. We kind of like got into sort of like nerdy pursuits. Other, you know, my best friend growing up, we'd always like illustrate together and draw and stuff. I wanted to make comic books when I was a kid, so kind of got into that. Just anything I could do that was creative. And we'd always dream of like what we go. It was a different thing every week. It was like, oh, we're going to do comic books. That's what we're going to do for the rest of our lives. I'm going to be a comic book artist when I grow up. Then next week, it's like, yeah, we're going to be in a band. You can't play an instrument, Ignacio. It doesn't matter. I learn, you know, it's just kind of very... And I did learn, but the band fell apart. It was a disaster. But that's not important. What is important is the creative ideal. And
What was the name of the band?
Were called the one that lasted the longest. I think was called The Fallen. Which, as it turns out, there was a bunch of other bands worldwide called The Fallen. But when we launched, which was I can't even remember. I was like 18, I think, at the time, and we were doing okay. Got some decent gigs. Got some radio play, you know, recorded and released an EP, or a demo at least, which got some radio play. But like, yeah, just band dynamics, man. We could have that moment like they do in every kind of like musical biopic, which is like, you know, the moment where you realize, oh, we found the sound or whatever, and then just the band falling apart and like not progressing any further. That would be the more realistic. You know, you never get that biopic where, like, you know, you found your sound, you're starting to get gigs, you record the demo, which is the big thing. And then the...
That's not what... Is that what is that what happened?
And then it all just collapses from there. So, I mean, I should say allegedly, but
right.
It was pretty obvious to anyone who looked at the evidence. Like, Columbo wouldn't have needed more than 30 seconds to figure it out.
I mean, can I ask, The Fallen?
Yeah.
Can I have a guess at the... genre or style of music?
Yeah, sure.
Was it quite heavy?
It wasn't too heavy. It was I think that's what an issue we had as well. It was like we definitely branded ourselves way heavier and darker than we were, because the music was like, it was like grunge music, you know what I mean? It wasn't nuts. It wasn't like that. It wasn't like high speed, like it wasn't like some of Soundgarden's like heavier stuff either. It wasn't even like Nirvana's like hardcore sort of punk influence. It was just a bit more chilled out. We're kind of like a grungy Killers. That's what I would describe us as. You know, the Killers. It's kind of like a pop sort of like sensibility to it. That's kind of what we sounded like.
Who wouldn't want to listen to that? And is it available? Are the tracks? No. They're not.
No. I lost the copy of it many MacBooks ago. I lost the music, and it was up there for a long time on MySpace. And then, you know, MySpace got rebought and changed so many times, and I think they gutted the whole system, because I used to go on there and kind of like for nostalgia years ago and just like listen to the EP.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Never mind.
Also, I love the 21st century update of the many moons ago, many MacBooks ago. That is like, that is a proper 21st century spin on such an age old saying. When the Fallen fell apart, was that the end of music for you? Did you say that was it? And then that was how did you get into stand up then after that?
Well, I continued then, because I was always writing songs and performing them. So I was just a singer-songwriter for a while, just solo. And I became the closing act of a regular comedy night in Swansea. So I would go on after the comedians when everyone's drinking up and just play music at the back. So I was doing other music gigs at the time, but that was one of my favorites, because I got to hang out with comics and get to watch comedy every night. And it's bizarre, because it clicked while I was in that club, like just how important comedy was to me and how much I loved stand-up. Because I'd always watched sort of stand-up specials as I was a kid, listened to kind of comedy albums with my dad and stuff. And then when I got to hang out with these comics and just chatting with them and having a laugh with them, and some of them like, oh, you should try stand-up. And it didn't even occur to me as I was growing up. I was like, shit, anyone can be a stand-up comedian. You know, you don't need to go off and do a course in it. I know some people do, but I didn't realize that you can just do it.
And what was your first gig? Could you have memories, recollections of that, or does it sit into your brain for right or wrong reasons?
No, the gig was really nice, but it was funny, the setup to it. So I was playing music at the end of this night. I was booked to do it, and a bunch of my friends, because I worked in a cinema at the time as well. A bunch of my friends from the cinema, the projectionists, they were on like their Christmas party, and they came up to the show And they asked the promoter on the door, he's like, oh, is Ignacio on tonight? And my friend Big Al, who used to work in the cinema,
Big
he
Al.
Kept saying, yeah, he's a very tall guy. It wasn't an ironic name. He's a very tall guy called Al. But he used to always say I should try stand-up because we just crack each other up in work. And I'd tell him about ideas and told him I was playing this comedy club regularly. And he kept sort of saying, you should try, you should do stand-up comedy. And then when he showed up with all of his colleagues from the projectionists, and I was meant to be on, he asked the promoter, is Ignacio on tonight? He was like, yeah. He's like, okay, great. Is he doing stand-up comedy? And the promoter was like, no. Because I'd been asking the promoter for months if I could do it, and he kept turning me down. So my friend was like, oh, okay, we'll leave. We're not going to buy tickets. And there was nearly a dozen of them. And the promoter just saw sort of dollar signs. He's like, no, come back. We're gonna stick him on. He's gonna do a set. And he was like, oh, comedy? He's like, yeah. And about 5 minutes before stage time, I think somebody big had been on, because I remember gigging lots with, like, Milton Jones had been there.
Right.
Dan Antopolsky, Russell Kane. So it was one of those kind of acts had closed. And the reason I don't remember it is because, I'd watched all of them and enjoyed it and then come backstage to kind of get ready to do my music thing, get my guitar ready. And just before I went up to perform, as everyone's clearing up and, going to the bar, the comedy night's over, it's just me playing while people drink and stuff. The promoter comes up and he goes, oh, before you do some songs tonight, tell some jokes, yeah? I was like, what? And he was like, yeah, tell some jokes. And I hadn't planned anything, I had all these sets I'd written, but I didn't think about them. So I went up and just ranted about work, working in the cinema for, 5-10 minutes, performed some characters for like funny customers and stuff like that had come in, acted out bits, told some jokes. And I saw people were laughing. I noticed the table and then I realized other people were laughing as well. So I was like, oh, this isn't just funny to projectionists. So people who work in the cinema. And I stuck with it. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
I mean, trying to corner the projectionist market in comedy, I mean, it's quite niche, isn't it? Like it probably doesn't pay the bills.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Well, it certainly doesn't after then either, because I think 90% of projectionists in the UK were made redundant as soon as the switch happened to digital. So
yeah.
Again, yeah, people have to move on and find something else.
It's the algorithm, isn't it? Again,
it's the algorithm. Yeah.
The algorithm. So did you, and that was it, was it? Was that literally it? And then that kind of flicked a switch.
My first gig, yeah. And it pretty much overnight, I was like, oh, I'm a comedian now. I didn't, and it wasn't like, oh, cancel everything. But I started just gigging straight off the back of that. Started messaging promoters, emailing. There used to be a thing, I don't know if you know, the Chortle Forum.
Right.
So Chortle, the comedy website, years ago, they used to have a forum. This is before everyone used to book gigs on Facebook and stuff. And they used to just troll the forum looking for opportunities, and you'd email the promoter and you tell them what you'd done previously. And, as you go along, you kind of like build up and you end up in places that you can invariably go up on stage and call it a shit-all.
Well, how long did it take you to find your voice? Like, obviously things always change and people change and always changing. But like, when did you kind of settle on the on stage Ignacio, like the version that you have on stage?
I think back then it was a really sort of unfiltered, very arrogant sort of persona I was kind of doing on stage. And that's certainly watered down. I've learned to enjoy myself more when I'm up there. And I think that kind of translates better. I think probably around about 2013, 2014, that's when I really sort of started coming into my own and being less less abrasive and less antagonistic, I think, with the crowd. So that's helped anyway in my work.
So which moments of your life would you want on the cutting room floor? What isn't making it into the movie, into Ignacio Lopez, the motion picture?
I would probably cut out a lot of, you'd have to have some in there, but the sheer amount of crap gigs I've done in my life and the sleeping on park benches and stuff. Like, it's okay to
what?
Show a bit of that.
Sleeping on park benches?
Yeah, man. I just, when I was starting out, because I was trying to do as many gigs as possible and I didn't have necessarily the money to get a hotel or to make my way home from something, I'd sort of do a gig and end up sleeping on a park bench or something until the first bus home. So that's kind of how I operated for first years of doing stand-up. And even up as recently as a few years ago, I used to finish my gigs, if it had gone well, I used to say, like, has anyone got a place for me to stay tonight? And if it had gone badly, well, I was sleeping on a park bench, wasn't I?
Okay. So firstly, park benches. Have you had any uncomfortable moments there? Have you had a bird, like woken up with a bird on your head or worse?
No, I got kicked off a park bench in Havant, down south of England, by a homeless person because I'd taken their bench. I didn't realize. I was just an empty bench in a park. I was sitting there, and a guy came over, and he was very angry that I'd taken his bench. Obviously, I let him out of the space straight away.
I mean, you must wait. I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, but it must be freezing, right? Waking up on a park bench.
Yeah, it's not pleasant. I mean, there wasn't a lot of sleeping involved. I think it was just a case of like lying, shivering and waiting until, you know, sun had risen and I could walk around, stretch a bit and get back on my cramped megabus or train or whatever it was I managed to pay for.
Jeepers creepers. And then you say when the gig's gone well, to tell you where I can stay. How often have people... you know, piped up and said, yeah, I can.
I've crashed with a few people's houses. You know, I'd make a joke out of it on stage, but like sometimes you'd get people approaching you after me, like, you can stay at mine. I'd be like, no. I'm gonna stay on a park bench, because obviously people needed to realize I wasn't it wasn't like a romantic thing. I didn't want to stay at somebody's, you know, apartment for romantic reasons. I mean, a long-term relationship, but you know, occasionally I'd have like drinks with sort of like a few guys involved in the club or something, and I'd end up sleeping on a sofa or something of a promoter. So
yeah,
it worked out okay sometimes, and I'm still alive to tell the tale anyway. We could definitely put some dramatic tension in the movie if we put a scene in where I end up back at some
to that
indie horror movie.
Yes, we are.
The
world's
trying to stray
right.
away from.
We are. Well, it's kind of like it reminded me then of I think when Derren Brown was doing that Russian roulette stunt. And the whole, you know, he had all those people turned up who wanted to be part of it. And anyone who sat in the front row, he immediately sent home because they were far too eager to fire a gun at his head, which is kind of like, you know, if someone rushes up to you afterwards and offered you a place to stay, you're like, bit too eager,
no.
Bit something bad's happening. You've got like a shed in a deserted park somewhere with a woodland.
Yeah.
So you've already mentioned a bit of Hitchcock and a bit of Saul Bass. But what are the influences on Ignacio Lopez, the motion picture, the influences from film or television or literature or comics? I mean, you mentioned you wanted to be an illustrator for about 10 minutes when you were younger. What other influences would be piling into this film?
The one that really made me want to be a filmmaker was The Matrix. And I just loved how that combined so many different genres and ideas in a really sort of stylized way. You know, it brought together things like anime and sort of kung fu with all of this philosophy and, you know, Westerns and all of these kind of ideas. And I love variety. Like I try to pack as much variety into my comedy sets as possible. That's why I do a bit of comedy music, one-liners, observation stories. So I think I try and take from The Matrix that the idea that you can combine all of these things. And also we're not dealing with reality. We're telling the story of a real person, but we can have flights of fantasy, you know, and you look at sort of like Ben Stiller's remake of the Walter Mitty movie, which I thought was fantastic, and just playing with his ideas and what's going on in his head. So I think we could combine a lot that way. Directing wise, I love the work of Takeshi Kitano, but I really don't want to shoot myself at the end of this movie. So because that tended to be like his go-to ending to any movie. It was like, and then he shoots himself.
I mean, how much do you love Keanu Reeves?
Yeah, big fan, a huge fan ever since, you know, Bill and Ted, you know, which is one of my favorite films ever. I think people were unjustifiably mean about him for a long time in his career. And I think he's really put his critics to one side. He never focused on that stuff and he just went out there and did what he wanted to do. I don't think people appreciate how difficult acting is either. I'm not saying it's like, you know, harder than like real work, because it's not. I'm in the arts, you know, we're in the arts. It's not real work, is it? I've done real work. It's not that. But I think people think acting is easy. And there's also a very stylized format of acting that's come through Hollywood and film and TV that people assume everyone is this emotive person. Whereas if you think about the people in your life, some people, you know, they're like perpetual poker face. You know, people complain sometimes about actors being wooden or whatever, like just one criticism people used to say about Keanu Reeves. I didn't find him particularly wooden. And, you know, most movies I watch him in, he's believable in the role and I feel like he's playing that character. There's not really bad actors. There's bad casting and bad directors. I think that's what the truth is, because look at him now, he's flying.
And scripts as well. Like if you know, you can be the best actor in the world, but if a script is stinky, You're basically, you're trapped, aren't you? You got nowhere to go.
Yeah, totally.
And have you seen the new Matrix film? I have not seen the new Matrix film. Do you like the new Matrix film?
It was okay. I think it's a solid 6 out of 10. Whereas like back when it was a trilogy, I loved all those movies, even though people hated the sequels. And
You know,
the first one made such an impact. But I liked Reloaded and Revolutions. And even if you take out the stuff people didn't like about it, they still really pushed cinema forward in ways that people weren't expecting. Whereas I think the new one, it hasn't really done anything new. It's fine. It tells its story. I think everyone's good in it.
Yeah.
But there was no surprises in it. There was nothing that really kind of like shook me out of my seat like the first time.
And you mentioned there Takeshi Kitano. That's Beat Kitano, right? And I'm trying to think of some of his films. I have seen one of them, but the name escapes me. If people wanted to kind of get into Takeshi Kitano, what would you recommend?
Well, he's quite a varied guy as well, because weirdly, I found out he started out in a comedy double act. So he was like a stage performer. The reason he got the name Beat Kitano is because they used to be like a very physical slapstick comedy double act. And it would invariably involve a lot of beating. And then he made Takeshi's Castle, which is the show, this Japanese game show where people rush to kind of win these, hundreds of them rush to win these crazy prizes.
Wait. Takeshi Kitano came up with Takeshi's Castle.
I don't know if he came up with it, but he's the front of it. It's called.
Oh, I see.
It's called Takeshi's Castle because it's his.
He's the presenter.
Well, not the presenter. It's his show. I mean, he's not in it necessarily, but it's his show. Like the concept and everything was all geared around beating Takeshi. Like, can you storm his castle?
Oh, I see. Yes, of course. I'm sorry. I've misread that. I did not know. That is...
Yeah, he might have come up with it. He's a smart guy. His movies, though, there's a film called Hanabi, which is, I think, the one which won a lot of the awards. I like Zatoichi as well for, like, a historical sort of samurai movie. It's farcical. It's a series about a blind samurai, this traditional story. Yeah, he's a very, very talented director. As an actor as well, he's in Battle Royale, which was a firm favorite of mine in my teenage years. I think his movies are very matter-of-fact, the way he directs. So the films he's actually directed himself. He's done some dramas as well. But the ones where he's acting in, they all involve typically Yakuza and crime families and that kind of thing.
You mentioned there Zatoichi, if I pronounced it correctly, about a blind samurai. But can it possibly match the cinematic masterpiece that is Blind Fury, starring Rutger Hauer, as similarly a blind samurai in contemporary America?
I think Blind Fury was definitely inspired by this this long history of Zatoichi, the blind samurai movie, because they've been making those movies for, like, I reckon, well over 50 years. It's a kind of old traditional Japanese tale.
Right.
I love Rutger Hauer and everything, man. But I think Zatoichi is the better film. I will go down on record as saying that.
If push comes to shove, I'll go with that. Yeah, fair enough. I wondered, critics though, Ignacio, critics, what would your reaction be if the critics love it or hate it? How would it affect you in your next project? And do you listen to critics? Are you affected by critics?
I think a long time ago, I would have been, I have been in the past when I've seen sort of the reviews or stuff people say, but the longer you go, the more you realize like none of it really matters. I mean, it's funny as well how in my last Edinburgh show, I got a 2-star, a 3-star, 3 4-stars and a 5-star review for the same show. I didn't change anything about it. The first review that came out on my birthday and it was a 2-star review. I woke up on my birthday to a 2-star review. It was the first one I got. And I was like, you know, what are you going to do?
Wow.
But the complaints, you know, the critics' complaints about it were things that the next critic loved about it. So, you know, it doesn't really have any standing with me. It certainly wouldn't affect. I think the only risk I run sometimes is if somebody gives me a criticism, I'm not going to change it to go with what they've said, unless it's somebody I trust. But like if we're talking critics or strangers on the internet or people in reviews and publications, I wouldn't change it to try and make it more like what they were going for. I run the risk of being stubborn and doubling down. So the thing that they maybe didn't like about it, I probably just go, well, we're doubling down on that then. If somebody said, for instance, my movie was too violent, the next one's going to be a bloodbath, you know? Or if somebody said... that it's if somebody was like, oh no, it's too childish, then the next movie would be the most silly childlike thing, like Pee-wee's Big Adventure or something. I'd really kind of stretch the genre the opposite direction. That's the only risk I think I'd run.
And what if they're really like, do you want to know about five-star reviews? Do you ask your agent or whoever to sort of tell you about them, or do you just don't want to know about any of them?
I remember talking to a friend of mine before. I think quite a healthy way of looking at things is the only reviews that matter are good reviews, because they're just to send people your way. The reviews aren't really for the filmmakers. It's for other people, whether they will like it or not. That's why a good review describes what the thing is, you know, without being unduly critical, because maybe that critic doesn't like one genre of movie, but they've got to appreciate, if they're reviewing a film that is that genre, will people who are fans of that genre enjoy it? And that's something people have to be honest about it.
And you know, you're going on tour later this year with 9 Ig Fails.
Yeah.
You run the risk then, don't you, of there being a reviewer in the audience who doesn't like 9 Inch Nails, which is what the show is kind of focused on. That's it. Like, if they don't like 9 Inch Nails, and that's the show gone for them, isn't it? In some ways.
No, it's quite the, so even though a show is talking about me traveling and going to see 9 Inch Nails, trying to get the money together to go see 9 Inch Nails in America, the show is very much, it was my first stab at writing like a feature length stand-up show that plays out like a movie, like narratively. So unlike previous shows, like you mentioned, my comedy album Españolo, which is about Spanish history, and it just dips into the different topics and stuff. And I've learned the long way around as well, how to make stuff applicable to an audience. So if I'm going on stage and talking about Spanish history, people in the UK couldn't give a flying fuck about Spanish history. You know, there's not, I'm not just putting it out there. You're genuinely, I'm talking like 99 out of 100 people wouldn't go watch a show that was about Spanish history.
I'm going to interrupt you and say you're completely wrong, because people in this country absolutely fucking love the Battle of Trafalgar. And that is, they could not get enough of that. That's a bit of Spanish history they love. They love that bit of Spanish history.
Yeah, but only if it's applicable to the UK. Like, for instance, you know, I talk about the Armada in my comedy album, and that's the bit where people would really wake up and like, oh, here we go. Here's one we won. So they want to kind of like talk about that sort of stuff. But the other kind of like Spanish history, it's not the type of show I think British people would flock to unless you make it applicable to them or funny or interesting. So I've kind of learned that I'm not going up and just doing like deep cuts of like my thoughts and opinions on Trent Reznor and his back catalog. That's not what the show is about. It's about, you know, fandom and like one person loving something so much that they would do anything to go experience it. And, you know, I talk about the worst gigs I've ever done again in the show. And I go talk through them. There's some sleeping on park benches and stuff, that kind of thing. But just trying to claw that money together, doing gigs I really should not have been doing. And people love to hear about gigs going wrong as well. You know, people don't care. People, although I've recently done Live at the Apollo and people have asked me about that, the most asked question I find from audience members, other than tell us a joke, is like, oh, so had any gigs where you've died, or what's the worst gig you've ever done? You know, that's what people want to know about. So that's what this show is. It's a nice bit of Schadenfreude, kind of looking at the pain of what it is pursuing your goals.
Before we move on, I must just ask, you know, just to give you your an opportunity, what is your favorite bit of Spanish history that you mention in Españolo? Or is there a favorite bit of Spanish history that you don't mention in Españolo?
I would have liked to have talked about the king of Spain, who was so inbred that he could barely function as a human being, but because of, you know, laws and the way monarchies work, he became the king of Spain. And I would love to do a deep dive into that and find out more about that. That's something I've got to do some more reading about.
Which king was that?
Oh, I don't know, man. That's the thing as well. I'm not great with history unless
it's a Philip. Is it a Philip? It's probably a Philip, right?
I think it could be. It could well be. Yeah, I don't know which, if he was the second or what, or the third. I'm not sure. But yeah, that would be something interesting to look into. I talk a lot about prejudice and Spain's colonial history and stuff in my stand-up, and how, you know, we're the bad guys for a lot of it. And it wasn't until after the Civil War and after Franco's reign that we started becoming a, you know, modern society where we don't, I say we, but the Spanish government doesn't try to kill people in our own nation anymore, or certainly not outside of it. I would like to talk about the Spanish-American War as well, the one that kind of set Spain down the wrong path through them losing territories to America. That's something I'd like to kind of like tackle. But if people want to listen to the comedy album, it's a lot of silly stuff in there as well, like the invention of tapas, how that came about,
Did that happen in Wales in
in 1990? Yeah, 1994 or something.
Well, congratulations, Ignacio. Ignacio Lopez, the motion picture, is in the can, and it's premiere night. Where's the premiere taking place, and who's invited?
I would love to do a simultaneous premiere, because I don't know if you've heard the story of, I believe it was Jurassic Park. Right. Do you know where Jurassic Park premiered?
I mean, I do not know. This is going to be good, isn't it?
Jurassic Park, there is a film coming out about this actual story and the truth in it. Jurassic Park premiered in London, like many films do. You know, the British premiere was airing in, screening in, I think, more than likely Leicester Square.
I think it was a royal one as well, wasn't it? It might have been a royal one.
Could well be, yeah. I mean, it was a huge impact. Was it 94 it came out? 93?
Yeah, 93.
But at the same time, somebody had managed to contact Steven Spielberg from a town called Carmarthen in South Wales and asked if he couldn't do something to help them, because they were trying to save this old cinema that was closing down in Carmarthen, this old theater cinema. And he'd like had films of his there before. They got in touch. They were trying to get like help from Hollywood, and he heard the story. He got in touch. And Steven Spielberg, who I believe plays himself in the film that's coming out about this, receiving the phone call and making this decision. So they actually premiered on the same night. People could either see Jurassic Park in Leicester Square or this little theater in Carmarthen in South Wales. So they had like a big sort of like, you know, premiere thing to save the theater, and it raised a lot of money. I think because of something to do with like licensing issues, or, you know, because the Leicester Square had to be the official one, I think they started the film a few minutes later.
Right.
In Carmarthen, so that the distributor wouldn't get pissed off. But like, it's such a silly thing. It's like, why would the distributor care, really? Like, nobody is going to go, are we going to dress up in a frock and go to the red carpet premiere in Leicester Square with all the celebrities? No, we're going to go down. All the press flock into Carmarthen in South Wales. So I don't think they needn't have worried about it, but it was a great thing to happen. So I would love to do a very similar thing. And I would like to have a simultaneous premiere in all of my favorite shitholes in Wales. Like, that would be the dream come true for me. You know, we'd have a cinema in Palma. So obviously the film would be starting, you know, at an earlier time slot, because they're an hour ahead over in Spain. But yeah, we have a premiere in Palma, which is where I was born. And then, you know, I'd chuck in a Newport in South Wales, and Neath, which is the closest place, or maybe even Ponta Dau, where my mom lives. And just have it in a few different places simultaneously.
Would anywhere that have to start before anyone else to avoid that sort of marketing faux pas, or is it?
No, man, I'd like to do a build up to it, maybe even like a live kind of like Q&A or presentation before it, and kind of talk about it. So I get to do a bit of stand up and people get to know the thing. And also that would mean a real surprise for them when it's like the guy the movie's about there saying, we've made this movie about my life. And then the movie starts and it's me in front of a firing squad, and they're like, what the hell is he talking about? How did this happen? I did want to say as well, the firing squad, the idea would be that we'd start with a firing squad, go back through my life, show it, all of this different stuff, and then we'd end up coming back to the point of the firing squad, and it turns out that I'm shooting a movie that I've written, and that I'm playing a character with this firing squad, so it would end with me walking off the set after shooting that scene, you know?
Big, beautiful twist!
Yeah, love a twist.
No one saw that coming. So I guess, who's invited to the premieres? I guess everyone's invited, because if you're having multiple premieres and multiple shitholes, anyone can come. Is that the idea? Basically, it's a free-for-all.
Yeah, almost. I mean, in Palma, I've got such a big family in Spain, I don't think there'd be much room for any other guests. my brother's getting married later this year, and as soon as my Spanish family found out, I mean, it doubled the size of the wedding. Like, it was huge. So I think if we were having it in Palma premiere, that's sorted. Maybe we'd have a couple of Spanish celebrities in there as well. In Wales, I mean, the one closest to Swansea, you've got to have the Welsh royalty there. You've got to have Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yes.
Oh, she can bring Michael Douglas along. It'd be great to see him there. You know, you've got Port Talbot is nearby as well. And that's like an actor factory. You know, they've churned out some of the biggest actors in history. You've got Anthony Hopkins is from there.
Yes.
Michael Sheen, you know, it'd be great to have all of them sort of turn up for a premiere in Wales as well.
Is anyone not invited? And if so, why? Is anyone not invited?
The people who beat the shit out of me on the rugby pitch. That would be my first list of people. I make a list of names. People can't make it. I don't even remember their names, but I'd recognize them. I'd have to stand on the door myself. I'd have to be doorman and present my own movie about my life. That's very me, actually, trying to do everything at once.
Well, there we have it. Ignacio Lopez, the motion picture, featuring sea caravans, sex education, the algorithm, clown porn, a glass monstrosity, Takeshi Kitano, a firing squad, Jimmy Smits, Pedro Pascal, and eating muddy Welsh fields. Ignacio Lopez, congratulations on being greenlit.
Thank you so much, man. I'm excited to start my publicity tour for this movie as well. I can't wait to get on the Graham Norton show and crack on with some of these stories.
Well, thanks for coming to us first. We really appreciate you putting Norton second to us. This is very kind of you.